names of the deceased guild brothers and sisters, did she cast a hasty glance toward the men's table. She caught a glimpse of him as he stood near the wall, behind the burning candle on the table. He was looking at her. The meal lasted a long time with all of the toasts in honor of God, the Virgin Mary, and Saint Margareta, Saint Olav, and Saint Hallvard, interspersed with prayers and hymns. Kristen could see through the open door that the sun had gone down. The sound of fiddles and songs could be heard from out on the green, and the young people had already left the tables when Fru Groa said to the young daughters that now they might go out to play for a while, if they so pleased. Three red bonfires were burning on the green. Around them moved the chains of dancers, now aglow, now in silhouette. The fiddlers were sitting on stacks of chests, bowing the strings of their instruments. They were playing and singing a different tune in each circle. There were far too many people to form only one dance. It was nearly dusk already. To the north, the crest of the forested ridges stood coal black against the yellowish-green sky. People were sitting under the gallery of the loft, drinking. Several men leaped up as soon as the six maidens from Nonnesetter came down the stairs. Munan Bardsson ran up to Ingebjörg and dashed off with her, and Kristen was seized by the wrist. It was Erlan. She already knew his touch. He gripped her hand so tightly that their rings scraped against each other and bit into their flesh. He pulled her along to the farthest bonfire, where many children were dancing. Kristen took a 12-year-old boy by the hand, and Erlan had a tiny, half-grown maiden on his other side. No one was singing in their circle just then. They walked and swayed from side to side, in time with the sound of the fiddle. Then someone shouted that Sivord the Dane should sing a new ballad for them. A tall, fair man with enormous fists stepped in front of the chain of dancers and performed his song. They are dancing now at Munkholm, across the white sand. There dances Ivar Herjonsson, taking the queen's hand. Do you know Ivar Herjonsson? The fiddle players didn't know the tune. They plucked a little on the strings, and the Dane sang alone. He had a beautiful, strong voice. Do you remember, Danish queen, that summer so clear, when you were led out of Sweden and to Denmark here? When you were led out of Sweden and to Denmark here, with a golden crown so red and on your cheek a tear. With a golden crown so red and on your cheek a tear. Do you remember, Danish queen, the first man you held dear? The fiddlers played along once more, and the dancers hummed the newly learned tune and joined in with the refrain. And are you, Ivar Herjonsson, my very own man? Then tomorrow from the gallows you shall surely hang. And it was Ivar Herjonsson, but he did not quail. He sprang into the golden boat, clad in coat of mail. May you be granted, Danish queen, as many good knights as do fill the vault of heaven, all the stars so bright. May you be granted, Danish king, life so fraught with cares, as the linden tree has leaves, and the heart has hairs. Do you know Ivar Herjonsson? It was late at night, and the bonfires were mere mounds of glowing embers that grew dimmer and dimmer. Kristen and Erlan stood hand in hand beneath the trees by the garden fence. Behind them, the noise of the revelers had died out. A few young boys were humming and leaping around the ember mounds, but the fiddlers had gone off to bed, and most of the people had left. Here and there a woman walked around in search of her husband, toppled by ale somewhere outdoors.
I wonder where I've left my cloak, whispered Kristen.
Erlan put his arm around her waist and wrapped his cape around both of them. Walking close together, they went into the herb garden. A remnant of the day's hot, spicy scent wafted toward them, muted and damp with the coolness of the dew. The night was quite dark, the sky hazy gray with clouds above the treetops.
but they sensed that others were in the garden. Erlan pressed the maiden to him once and asked in a whisper, "You're not afraid, are you, Kristen?" Suddenly, she vaguely remembered the world outside this night. It was madness. But she was so blissfully robbed of all power. She leaned closer to the man and whispered faintly. She didn't know herself what she said. They reached the end of the path. There was a stone fence along the edge of the woods. Erlan helped her up. As she was about to jump down to the other side, he caught her and held her in his arms for a moment before he set her down in the grass. She stood there with her face raised and received his kiss. He placed his hands at her temples. She thought it so wonderful to feel his fingers sinking into her hair, and then she put her hands up to his face and tried to kiss him the way he had kissed her. When he placed his hands on her bodice and stroked her breasts, she felt as if he had laid her heart bare and then seized it. Gently he parted the folds of her silk shift and kissed the place in between. Heat rushed to the roots of her heart. "You I could never hurt," whispered Erlan. "Don't ever weep a single tear for my sake. I never thought a maiden could be as good as you are, my Kristen." He pulled her down into the grass under the bushes. They sat with their backs against the stone fence. Kristen said not a word, but when he stopped caressing her, she raised her hand and touched his face. After a moment, Erlan asked, "Are you tired, dear Kristen?" And when she leaned against his chest, he wrapped his arms around her and whispered, "Sleep, Kristen. Sleep here with me." She slipped deeper and deeper into the darkness and the warmth and the joy at his chest. When she woke up, she was lying stretched out on the grass with her cheek against the brown silk of his lap. Erlan was still sitting with his back against the stone fence. His face was gray in the gray light, but his wide-open eyes were so strangely bright and beautiful. She saw that he had wrapped his cape all around her. Her feet were wonderfully warm inside the fur lining. "Now you have slept on my lap," he said, smiling faintly. "May God reward you, Kristen. You slept as soundly as a child in her mother's arms."
"Haven't you slept, Herr Erlan?" asked Kristen, and he smiled down into her newly awakened eyes.
"Perhaps someday the night will come when you and I dare to fall asleep together. I don't know what you will think once you have considered that. I have kept vigil here in the night. There is still so much between us, more than if a naked sword had lain between you and me. Tell me, will you have affection for me after this night is over?"
"I will have affection for you, Herr Erlan," said Kristen. "I will have affection for you as long as you wish. And after that, I will love no one else."
"Then may God forsake me," said Erlan slowly, "if ever a woman or maiden should come into my arms before I dare to possess you with honor and in keeping with the law. Repeat what I have said," he implored her.
Kristen said, "May God forsake me if I ever take any other man into my arms for as long as I live on this earth."
"We must go now," said Erlan after a moment, "before everyone wakes up."
They walked along the outside of the stone fence, through the underbrush.
"Have you given any thought to what should happen next?" asked Erlan.
"You must decide that, Erlan," replied Kristen.
"Your father," he said after a pause, "over in Gerdaru they say that he's a kind and just man. Do you think he would be greatly opposed to breaking the agreement he has made with Andres Dare?"
"Father has so often said that he would never force any of his daughters," said Kristen. "The main concern is that our lands would fit so well together. But I'm certain that Father would not want me to lose all joy in the world for that reason."
She had a sudden inkling that it might not be quite as simple as that, but she pushed it aside.
"Then maybe this will be easier than I thought last night," said Erlan. "God help me, Kristen. I can't bear to lose you. Now I will never be happy if I can't have you."
They parted among the trees, and in the dim light of dawn, Kristen found the path to the guest house, where everyone from Nonaceter was sleeping. All the beds were full, but she threw her cloak over some straw on the floor and lay down in her clothes. When she woke up, it was quite late. Ingibjörg Philippa's daughter was sitting on a bench nearby, mending a fur border that had torn loose from her cloak. She was full of chatter as always.
"Were you with Erland Nikolason all night long?" she asked. "You ought to be a little more careful about that young man, Kristen. Do you think Simon Andersson would like it if you befriended him?"
Kristen found a basin and began to wash herself.
"And what about your betrothed? Do you think he would like it that you danced with Munon the Stump last night? But we have to dance with anyone who invites us on such an evening, and Fru Groa gave us permission after all."
Ingibjörg exclaimed,
"Einar Einarsson and Sir Munon are friends, and besides, he's married and old. And he's ugly too, but amiable and courteous. Look what he gave me as a souvenir of the night."
And she held out a gold buckle which Kristen had seen on Sir Munon's hat the day before.
"But that Erland, well, the ban was lifted from him this past Easter, but they say that Elina Orm's daughter has been staying at his manor at Husaby ever since. Sir Munon says that he has fled to Sir Jon at Gerderu because he's afraid that he'll fall back into sin if he sees her again."
Kristen, her face white, went over to the other girl.
"Didn't you know that?"
asked Ingibjörg.
"That he lured a woman from her husband somewhere up north in Hålogaland? And that he kept her at his estate in spite of the king's warning and the archbishop's ban? They have two children together, too. He had to flee to Sweden, and he has had to pay so many fines that Sir Munon says he'll end up a pauper if he doesn't mend his ways soon."
"Oh, yes. You can be sure that I knew all about it," said Kristen, her face rigid.
"But that's all over now." "Yes, that's what Sir Munon said, that it's been over between them so many times before," replied Ingibjörg thoughtfully. "It won't affect you. You're going to marry Simon Dara after all. But that Erland Nikolason is certainly a handsome man."
The company from Nonaceter was going to leave that same day, after the mid-afternoon prayers. Kristen had promised Erland to meet him at the stone fence where they had sat during the night, if she could find a way to come. He was lying on his stomach in the grass, with his head on his arms. As soon as he saw her, he leaped up and offered her both of his hands as she was about to jump down. She took them, and they stood for a moment, hand in hand. Then Kristen said,
"Why did you tell me that story about Herr Björn and Fru Asild yesterday?"
"I can see that you know," replied Erland, abruptly letting go of her hands. "What do you think of me now, Kristen?" "I was 18 years old back then," he continued vehemently. "It was 10 years ago that the king, my kinsman, sent me on the journey to Varger House, and then we spent the winter at Steigen. She was married to the judge Sigurd Saxuvern. I felt sorry for her because he was old and unbelievably ugly. I don't know how it happened. Yes, I was fond of her too. I told Sigurd to demand what he wanted in fines. I wanted to do right by him. He's a decent man in many ways. But he wanted things to proceed according to the law, and he took the case to the ting. I was to be branded for adultery with a woman in whose house I had been a guest, you see. My father got wind of it, and then King Håkon found out too, and he banished me from his court. And if you need to know the whole story, there's nothing left between Elina and me except the children, and she cares very little for them. They're at Ørstedal, on a farm that I own there. I've given the farm to Orm, the boy. But she doesn't want to be with them. I suppose she expects that Sigurd can't live forever, but I don't know what she wants. Sigurd took her back, but she says she was treated like a dog and a slave on his farm, so she asked me to meet her in Nidaros. I was not faring much better at Husaby with my father, I sold everything I could get my hands on and fled with her to Holland. Count Jakob has been a kind friend to me. What else could I do? She was carrying my child. I knew that so many men had managed to escape unscathed from such a relationship with another man's wife, if they were rich, that is. But King Håkon is the sort of man who treats his own most sternly. We were separated from each other for a year, but then my father died, so she came back. And then other things happened. My tenants refused to pay their land rent or to speak to my envoys because I had been excommunicated. I retaliated harshly, and then a case was brought against me for robbery, but I had no money to pay my house servants. You can see that I was too young to deal sensibly with these difficulties, and my kinsmen refused to help me, except for Munan, who did as much as he dared without angering his wife. So now you know, Kristen, that I have compromised much, both my land and my honor. You would certainly be much better served if you stayed with Simon Andersen.
Kristen put her arms around his neck. We will stand by what we swore to each other last night, Erlan. If you feel as I do.
Erlan pulled her close, kissed her, and then said, You must also have faith that my circumstances are bound to change. Now, no one in the world has power over me except you. Oh, I thought about so many things last night as you lay asleep in my lap, my fair one. The devil cannot have so much power over a man that I would ever cause you sorrow or harm. You, who are the most precious thing in my life.
Chapter 4 During the time he lived at Skog, Lavrans Björgolfsson had given property to Gerderud Church for requiems to be held for the souls of his parents on the anniversaries of their deaths. His father, Björgul Kettleson's death date was the 13th of August, and this year Lavrans had made arrangements for his brother to bring Kristen out to his estate so that she could attend the mass. She was afraid that something might happen to prevent her uncle from keeping his promise. She thought she had noticed that Osmund was not particularly fond of her. But on the day before the mass was to be held, Osmund Björgulfsson arrived at the convent to get his niece. Kristen was told to dress in secular attire, but dark and simple in appearance. People had begun to remark that the sisters of Nonnesetter spent a great deal of time outside the convent, and the bishop had therefore decreed that the young daughters who were not to become nuns should not wear anything resembling convent garb when they went to visit their kinsmen. Then the populace would not mistake them for novices or nuns of the order. Kristen was in a joyous mood as she rode along the road with her uncle, and Osmund became more cheerful and friendly toward her when he noticed that the maiden was an affable companion. Otherwise, Osmund was rather dejected. He said it seemed likely that a campaign was about to be launched in the fall, and that the king would sail with his army to Sweden to avenge the vile deed that had been perpetrated against his brother-in-law and his niece's husband. Kristen had heard about the murder of the Swedish dukes and thought it an act of the worst cowardice, although all such affairs of the realm seemed so distant to her. No one talked much about such things back home in the valley. But she also remembered that her father had participated in the campaign against Duke Eirik at Ronhill Arholm and Konunga Hela. Osmund explained everything that had happened between the king and the dukes. Kristen didn't understand much of what he said, but she paid close attention to what her uncle told her about the betrothals that had been agreed upon and then broken by the king's daughters. It gave her some comfort to hear that it was not the same in all places as it was back home in the villages, where an arranged betrothal was considered almost as binding as a marriage. So she gathered her courage, told her uncle about her adventures on the evening before the vigil of St. Hallvard, and asked him whether he knew Erlan of Huseby. Osmund gave Erlan a good report, saying that he had acted unwisely, but that his father and the king were mostly to blame. He said they had behaved as if the boy had been the horn of the devil himself because he had landed in such a predicament. The king was much too pious, and Sir Nikolaus was angry because Erlan had wasted so much good property,
So they had both thundered about adultery and the fires of hell. Any able-bodied young man has to have a certain amount of defiance in him, said Osmund Bjørgulfsson, and the woman was exceedingly beautiful. But you have no reason to have anything to do with Erlon, so pay no heed to his affairs.
Erlon did not attend the mass as he had promised Kristen he would, and she thought more about this than about the word of God. But she felt no remorse over it. She merely had the odd feeling of being a stranger to everything to which she had previously felt herself bound. She tried to console herself. Erlon probably thought it best that no one who had authority over her should find out about their friendship. She could understand this herself. But she had longed to see him with all her heart, and she wept when she went to bed that evening in the loft, where she slept with Osmund's small daughters. The next day she headed up toward the woods with the youngest of her uncle's children, a little maiden 6 years old. When they had gone some distance, Erlon came running after them. Kristen knew who it was before she even saw him.
I've been sitting up here on the hill looking down at the farmyard all day long, he said. I was sure that you'd find some chance to slip away.
Do you think I've come out here to meet you? Said Kristen with a laugh. And aren't you afraid to be wandering in my uncle's woods with your dogs and bow?
Your uncle has given me permission to hunt here for a short time, said Erlon. And the dogs belong to Osmund. They found me up here this morning.
He patted the dogs and picked up the little girl.
You remember me, don't you, Rondit? But you mustn't say that you've talked to me, and then I'll give you this.
He took out a little bundle of raisins and handed it to the child.
I had intended it for you, he told Kristen. Do you think this child can keep quiet?
Both of them spoke quickly and laughed. Erlon was wearing a short, snug brown tunic, and he had a small red silk cap pressed down onto his black hair. He looked so young. He laughed and played with the child, but every once in a while he would take Kristen's hand, squeezing it so hard it hurt. He talked about the rumors of the campaign with joy.
Then it will be easier for me to win back the friendship of the king. Everything will be easier then, he said fervently.
At last they sat down in a meadow some distance up in the woods. Erlon had the child on his lap. Kristen sat at his side. He was playing with her fingers in the grass. He put into her hand three gold rings tied together with a string.
Later on, he whispered to her, you shall have as many as you can fit on your fingers. I'll wait for you here in this field every day at this time, for as long as you are at Skog, he said as they parted. Come when you can.
The next day Osmund Bjørgulfsson, along with his wife and children, left for Hiri's ancestral state at Hadalen. They had become alarmed by the rumors of the campaign. The people around Oslo were still filled with terror ever since Duke Eirik's devastating incursion into the region some years before. Osmund's old mother was so frightened that she decided to seek refuge at Nonnesetter. She was too frail to travel with the others. So Kristen would stay at Skog with the old woman, whom she called grandmother, until Osmund returned from Hadalen. Around noontime, when the servants on the farm were resting, Kristen went up to the loft where she slept. She had brought along some clothing in a leather bag, and she hummed as she changed her clothes. Her father had given her a dress made of thick cotton fabric from the east. It was sky blue with an intricate red flower pattern. This is what she put on. She brushed and combed out her hair, tying it back from her face with red silk ribbons. She wrapped a red silk belt tightly around her waist and slipped Erlon's rings onto her fingers, all the while wondering whether he would find her beautiful. She had let the two dogs that had been up in the forest with Erlon sleep in the loft with her at night. Now she enticed them to come with her. She sneaked around the buildings and took the same path up through the outlying fields that she had used the day before. The forest meadow lay empty and still in the glare of the noonday sun. There was a hot fragrance coming from the spruce trees that surrounded it on all sides. The blazing sun and the blue sky seemed strangely close and harsh against the treetops. Kristen sat down in the shade at the edge of the clearing. She wasn't disappointed at Erlan's absence. She was sure that he would come, and she felt a peculiar joy at being allowed to sit there alone, the first to arrive. She listened to the soft buzz of insects across the yellow, scorched grass. She plucked off several dry, spice-scented flowers that she could reach without moving more than her hand. She twirled them between her fingers and sniffed at them. With her eyes wide open, she sank into a kind of trance. She didn't move when she heard a horse approaching from the forest. The dogs growled and raised their hackles. Then they bounded up across the meadow, barking and wagging their tails. Erlan jumped down from his horse at the edge of the forest and let it go with a slap on its loins. Then he ran down toward Kristen with the dogs leaping around him. He grabbed their snouts with his hands and walked toward her between the two animals, which were elk gray and wolf-like. Kristen smiled and reached out her hand without getting up. Once, as she was looking down at his dark brown head lying in her lap between her hands, a memory abruptly rose up before her. It stood there, clear and distant, the way a house far off on the slope of a ridge can suddenly emerge quite clearly from the dark clouds as it is struck by a ray of sunshine on a turbulent day. And her heart suddenly seemed filled with all of the tenderness that Arne Geirdsson had once wanted, back when she hardly even understood his words. Anxiously, she drew the man to her, pressing his face against her breast, kissing him as if she were afraid that he might be taken from her. And when she looked at his head lying in her embrace, she thought it was like having a child in her arms. She hid his eyes with her hand and sprinkled little kisses over his mouth and cheek. The sun had disappeared from the meadow. The intense color above the treetops had deepened to a dark blue, spreading over the entire sky. There were small copper-red streaks in the clouds, like smoke from a fire. Bayard came toward them, gave a loud whinny, and then stood motionless, staring. A moment later, the first lightning flashed, followed at once by thunder, not far away. Erlan stood up and took the reins of the horse. There was an old barn at the bottom of the meadow, and that's where they headed. He tethered Bayard to some planks just inside the door. In the back of the barn was a mound of hay, and there Erlan spread out his cape. They sat down with the dogs at their feet. Soon the rain had formed a curtain in front of the doorway. The wind rushed through the forest, and the rain lashed against the hillside. A moment later, they had to move farther inside because of a leak in the roof. Every time there was lightning and thunder, Erlan would whisper, "Aren't you afraid, Kristen?"
"A little,"
she would whisper back, and then press closer to him. They had no idea how long they sat there. The storm passed over quite quickly, and they could still hear the thunder far away, but the sun was shining outside the door in the wet grass, and fewer glittering drops were falling from the roof. The sweet smell of hay grew stronger in the barn.
"I have to go now," said Kristen.
And Erlan replied, "I suppose you do." He put his hand on her foot. "You'll get wet. You must ride, and I'll walk. Out of the forest." He gave her such a strange look. Kristen was trembling. She thought it was because her heart was pounding so hard, and her hands were clammy and cold. When he kissed the bare skin above her knee, she tried powerlessly to push him away. Erlan raised his face for a moment, and she was suddenly reminded of a man who had once been given food at the convent. He had kissed the bread they handed to him. She sank back into the hay with open arms and let Erlan do as he liked. She was sitting bolt upright when Erlan lifted his head from his arms. Abruptly, he propped himself up on his elbow. "Don't look like that, Kristen." His voice etched a wild new pain into Kristen's soul. He wasn't happy. He was distressed too. "Kristen, Kristen." And a moment later, he asked,
Do you think I lured you out here to the woods because I wanted this from you? To take you by force?
She stroked his hair but didn't look at him. I wouldn't call it force. No doubt you would have let me go as I came, if I had asked you to, she said softly.
I'm not sure of that, he replied, hiding his face in her lap. Do you think I will forsake you? He asked fervently. Kristen, I swear on my Christian faith. May God forsake me in my last hour if I fail to be faithful to you until I die.
She couldn't say a word. She merely caressed his hair, over and over. Now, surely, it must be time for me to go home, she said at last, and she felt as if she were waiting with dread for his reply.
I suppose it is, he said gloomily.
He stood up quickly, went over to his horse, and began to untie the reins. Then Kristen stood up too, slowly, feeling faint and shattered. She didn't know what she had expected him to do. Perhaps help her up onto his horse and take her along with him so that she could avoid going back to the others. Her whole body seemed to be aching with astonishment that this was the iniquity that all the songs were about. And because Erlan had done this to her, she felt as if she had become his possession, and she couldn't imagine how she could live beyond his reach anymore. She was going to have to leave him now, but she could not conceive of doing so. Down through the woods he walked, leading the horse and holding Kristen's hand in his, but they could think of nothing to say to each other. When they had gone so far that they could see the buildings of Skog, he said farewell.
Kristen, don't be sad. Before you know it, the day will come when you'll be my wife.
But her heart sank as she spoke. Then you have to leave me? She asked fearfully.
As soon as you've left Skog, he said, and his voice sounded more vibrant all at once. If there's no campaign, then I'll speak to Munan. He's been urging me for a long time to get married. I'm certain he'll accompany me and speak to your father on my behalf.
Kristen bowed her head. For every word he spoke, the time that lay before her seemed longer and more impossible to imagine. The convent, Urengard. It was as if she were floating in a stream that was carrying her away from everything.
Do you sleep alone in the loft, now that your kinsmen have gone? Asked Erlan. If so, I'll come and talk to you tonight. Will you let me in?
Yes, murmured Kristen. And then they parted. The rest of the day, Kristen sat with her grandmother, and after the evening meal she helped the old woman into bed. Then she went up to the loft where she slept. There was a small window in the room, and Kristen sat down on the chest that stood beneath it. She had no desire to go to bed. She had to wait for a long time. It was pitch dark outside when she heard the quiet footsteps on the gallery. He tapped on the door with his cape wrapped around his knuckles, and Kristen stood up, drew back the bolt, and let Erlan in. She noticed that he was pleased when she threw her arms around his neck and pressed herself against him.
I was afraid you'd be angry with me, he said.
Sometime later he said,
You mustn't grieve over this sin. It's not a great one. God's law is not the same as the law of the land in this matter. Gunnulf, my brother, once explained it all to me. If two people agree to stand by each other for all eternity and then lie with each other, they are married before God and cannot break their vows without committing a great sin. I would tell you the word in Latin if I could remember it. I knew it once.
Kristen wondered what could have been the reason for Erlan's brother to speak of this, but she brushed aside the nagging fear that it might have been about Erlan and someone else, and she sought solace in his words. They sat next to each other on the chest. Erlan put his arm around Kristen, and now she felt warm and secure. At his side was the only place she would ever feel safe and protected again. From time to time, Erlan would say a great deal, speaking elatedly. Then he would fall silent for long periods, simply caressing her.
Without knowing it, Kristen was gathering up from all he said every little thing that might make him more attractive and dear to her, and that would lessen his blame in all she knew about him that was not good. Erlan's father, Sir Nikolaus, was so old when his children were born that he had neither the patience nor the ability to raise them himself. Both sons had grown up in the home of Sir Bard Peterson of Hestness. Erland had no siblings other than his brother Gunulf, who was 1 year younger and a priest at Christ Church.
I love him more dearly than anyone, except for you.
Kristen asked Erland whether Gunulf looked like him, but he laughed and said they were quite different in both temperament and appearance. Gunulf was abroad, studying. This was the third year he had been gone, but twice he had sent letters home. The last one arrived the year before, when he was about to leave Sancta Genoveva in Paris and head for Rome.
Gunulf will be happy when he comes home and finds me married, said Erlan.
Then he talked about the vast inheritance he had acquired from his parents. Kristen realized that he hardly knew himself how his affairs now stood. She was quite familiar with her father's land dealings, but Erlan's dealings had been of the opposite kind. He had sold and scattered, mortgaged and squandered his property, especially during the past few years as he had tried to separate from his mistress, thinking that with time his wild life would be forgotten and his kinsmen would take him back. He had believed that in the end he would be named sheriff of half of Orkdala County, just as his father had been.
But now, I have no idea how things will finally go, he said. Maybe I'll end up on a farm on some scruffy slope like Bjorn Gunnarsson. And I'll have to carry out the dung on my back the way slaves used to do in the past, because I own no horses.
God help you, said Kristen, laughing. Then I'd better come with you. I think I know more about peasant ways than you do.
But I don't imagine that you've ever carried a dung basket, he said, laughing too.
No, but I've seen how they spread out the muck, and I've sown grain almost every year back home. My father usually plows the closest fields himself, and then he lets me sow the first section because I'll bring him luck.
The memory painfully pierced her heart, and she said hastily, And you'll need a woman to bake and brew the weak ale and wash out your only shirt and do the milking. You'll have to lease a cow or two from the nearest wealthy farmer.
Oh, thank God I can hear you laugh a little once again, said Erlan, taking her onto his lap so that she lay in his arms like a child.
During the 6 nights before Osmund Bjørgulfsson returned home, Erlan came up to the loft to be with Kristen each evening. On the last night, he seemed just as unhappy as she was. He said many times that they would not be parted from each other a day longer than was necessary. Finally, he said in a subdued voice,
If things should go so badly that I cannot return here to Oslo before winter, and you happen to be in need of a friend's help, then you can safely turn to Sira Jon here at Gerderu. We've been friends since childhood. And Munan Bardsson you can also trust.
Kristen could only nod. She realized that he was talking about the same thing that had been on her mind every single day. But Erlan didn't mention it again. Then she was silent too, not wanting to show him how sick at heart she felt. The other times he had left her as the hour grew late, but on this last night, he pleaded earnestly to be allowed to lie down and sleep with her for a while. Kristen was afraid, but Erlan said defiantly,
You should realize that if I'm discovered here in your chamber, I know how to defend myself.
She wanted so badly to keep him with her a little longer, and she was incapable of refusing him anything. But she was worried that they might sleep too long, so for most of the night she sat up, leaning against the headboard, dozing a little now and then, not always conscious of when he was actually caressing her, and when she had simply dreamed it. She kept one hand on his chest, where she could feel the beat of his heart, and turned her face toward the window so she could watch for the dawn outside. Finally, she had to wake him. She threw on some clothes and walked out onto the gallery with him.
He leaped over the railing on the side of the house facing another building. Then he disappeared around the corner. Kristen went back inside and crawled into bed again. Then she let herself go and wept for the first time since she had become Erlan's possession. Chapter 5. At Nonneseder, the days passed as they had before. Kristen spent her time in the dormitory and the church, the weaving room, the library, and the refectory. The nuns and the convent servants harvested the crops of the herb garden and orchard. Holy Cross Day arrived in the fall with its procession, and then came the time of fasting before Michaelmas. Kristen was astonished that no one seemed to notice anything different about her. But she had always been quiet in the company of strangers, and Ingelbjerg Philippa's daughter, who was her companion day and night, managed to talk enough for both of them. So no one noticed that her thoughts were far away from everything around her. Erlan's mistress. She told herself this. Now she was Erlan's mistress. It was as if she had dreamed it all. The evening of St. Margareta's Day, the time in the barn, the nights in her bedchamber at Skog. Either she had dreamed all that, or she was dreaming now. But one day she would have to wake up. One day it would all come out. Not for a moment did she doubt that she was carrying Erlan's child. But she couldn't really imagine what would happen to her when this came to light, whether she would be thrown into a dark cell or be sent home. Far off in the distance, she glimpsed the faint images of her father and mother. Then she would close her eyes, dizzy and sick, submerged by the imagined storm, trying to steel herself to bear the misfortune, which she thought would inevitably end with her being swept into Erlan's arms for all eternity, the only place where she now felt she had a home. So in this sense of tension, there was just as much anticipation as there was terror. There was sweetness as well as anguish. She was unhappy, but she felt that her love for Erlan was like a plant that had been sown inside her. And for every day that passed, it sprouted a new and even lusher abundance of flowers, in spite of her misery. She had experienced the last night that he had slept with her as a delicate and fleeting sweetness, and a passion and joy awaited her in his embrace which she had never known before. Now she trembled at the memory. It felt to her like the hot, spicy gust from the sun-heated gardens. Wayside bastard. Those were the words that Inga had flung at her. She reached out for the words and held them tight. Wayside bastard. A child that had been conceived in secret in the woods or meadows. She remembered the sunshine and the smell of the spruce trees in the glade. Every new trickling sensation, every quickened pulse in her body she took to be the unborn child, reminding her that now she had ventured onto new paths, and no matter how difficult they might be to follow, she was certain that in the end, they would lead her to Erlan. She sat between Ingebjerg and Sister Astrid, embroidering on the great tapestry with the knights and birds beneath the twining leaves. All the while she was thinking that she would run away once her condition could no longer be concealed. She would walk along the road, dressed as a poor woman, with all the gold and silver she owned knotted into a cloth in her hand. She would pay for a roof over her head at a farm somewhere in an isolated village. She would become a servant woman, carrying water buckets on a yoke across her shoulders. She would tend to the stables, do the baking and washing, and suffer curses because she refused to name the father of her child. Then Erland would come and find her. Sometimes she imagined that he would come too late. Snow-white and beautiful, she would be lying in the poor peasant bed. Erland would lower his head as he stepped through the doorway. He was wearing the long black cape he had worn when he came to her on those nights at Skog. The farm woman had led him to the room where she lay. He sank down and took her cold hands in his eyes desperate with grief. "Is this where you are, my only joy?" Then, bowed with sorrow, he would leave,
with his infant son pressed to his breast inside the folds of his cape. No, that's not how she wanted things to end. She didn't want to die, and Erlan must not suffer such a sorrow. But she was so despondent, and it helped to think such things. Then, all of a sudden, it became chillingly clear to her. The child was not something she had merely imagined. It was something inevitable. One day she would have to answer for what she had done, and she felt as if her heart had stopped in terror. But after some time had passed, she realized it was not as certain as she had thought that she was with child. She didn't understand why this did not make her happy. It was as if she had been lying under a warm blanket, weeping. Now she had to get up and step into the cold. Another month passed, then another. Finally, she was convinced. She had escaped that misfortune. Freezing and empty, she now felt more unhappy than ever, and in her heart, a tiny bitterness toward Erlan was brewing. Advent was approaching, and she had not heard a word, either about him or from him. She had no idea where he was. And now she felt she could no longer endure the anguish and uncertainty. It was as if a bond between them had been broken. Now she was truly frightened. Something might happen, and she would never see him again. She was separated from everything she had been bound to in the past, and the bond between them was such a fragile one. She didn't think that he would forsake her. But so many things might happen. She couldn't imagine how she would be able to stand the day-to-day uncertainty and agony of this waiting time any longer. Sometimes she would think about her parents and sisters. She longed for them, but with the feeling that she had lost them for good. And occasionally in church, and at other times as well, she would feel a fervent yearning to become part of it all, this community with God. It had always been part of her life, and now she stood outside with her unconfessed sin. She told herself that this separation from her home and family and Christianity was only temporary. But Erlan would have to lead her back by the hand. When Lavrans consented to the love between her and Erlan, then she would be able to go to her father as she had before. And after she and Erlan were married, they would make confession and atone for their offense. She began looking for evidence that other people, like herself, were not without sin. She paid more attention to gossip, and she took note of all the little things around her which indicated that not even the sisters in the convent were completely holy and unworldly. There were only small things. Under Fru Groa's guidance, Nonna Setter was, in the eyes of the outside world, exactly as a holy order of nuns ought to be. The nuns were zealous in their service to God, diligent, and attentive to the poor and the sick. Confinement to the cloister was not so strictly enforced that the sisters could not receive visits from their friends and kinsmen in the parlatory, nor were they prevented from returning these visits in the town if the occasion so warranted. But no nun had ever brought shame upon the order through her actions in all the years that Fru Groa had been in charge. Kristen had now developed an alert ear for all the small disturbances within the convent's walls, little complaints and jealousies and vanities. Other than nursing, no nun would lend a hand with the rough housework. They all wanted to be learned and skilled women. Each one tried to outshine the other, and those sisters who did not have talent for such refined occupations gave up and drifted through the hours as if in a daze. Fru Groa herself was both learned and wise. She kept a vigilant eye on the conduct and industry of her spiritual daughters, but she paid little heed to the welfare of their souls. She had always been friendly and kind toward Kristen, and seemed to favor her above the other young daughters, but that was because Kristen was well-trained in book learning and needlework, and was diligent and quiet. Fru Groa never expected replies from the sisters. On the other hand, she enjoyed talking to them. They came and went in her parlatory. Landholders and envoys associated with the convent, predicant brothers from the bishop, and representatives from the cloister at Hoveder,
with which she was involved in a legal matter. She had her hands full tending to the convent's large estates, the accounts, sending out clerical garb, and taking in and then sending off books to be copied. Not even the most ill-tempered person could find anything improper about Fru Groa's behavior. She simply liked to talk about those things that women seldom knew anything about. The prior, who lived in a separate building north of the church, seemed to have no more will than the reed pen or switch of the abbess. Sister Potencia, for the most part, ruled the house. She was primarily intent on maintaining the customs that she had observed in the distinguished German convents where she had lived during her novitiate. Her former name was Sigrid Ronvald's daughter, but she had changed her name when she assumed the habit of the order, as was the custom in other countries. She was also the one who had decided that the pupils, who were only at Nonneseter for a short time, should also wear the attire of young novices. Sister Cecilia Bard's daughter was not like the other nuns. She walked around in silence, her eyes downcast. She always replied meekly and humbly, acted as everyone's maidservant, preferred to take on the roughest tasks, and fasted more often than was prescribed, as much as Fru Groa would allow. And in church, she would kneel for hours after the evening hymn, or go there long before matins. But one evening, after she had spent the whole day at the creek washing clothes along with two lay sisters, she suddenly began to sob loudly at the supper table. She threw herself onto the stone floor, crawled on her knees among the sisters, and beat her breast. With burning cheeks and streaming eyes, she begged them to forgive her. She was the worst sinner of them all. She had been stone hard with arrogance all her days. It was arrogance and not humility or gratitude for the death of Christ the Savior that had sustained her when she was tempted in the world. She had fled to the convent not because she loved a man's soul, but because she had loved her own pride. She had served her sisters with arrogance. She had drunk vanity from her water goblet, and she had spread her bare bread thick with conceit, while the sisters drank ale and ate butter on their bread. From all this, Kristen understood that not even Cecilia Bard's daughter was completely pure of heart. An unlit tallow candle that was hung from the ceiling and turned filthy with soot and cobwebs. That was how she compared her loveless chastity. Fru Groa herself went over and lifted up the sobbing young woman. Sternly, she said that as punishment for her outburst, Cecilia would move from the sisters' dormitory into the abbess's own bed and stay there until she had recovered from this fever. "And then, Sister Cecilia, you will sit in my chair for 8 days. We will ask your advice in spiritual matters and show you such respect because of your godly conduct that you will grow sated from the tribute of sinful people. Then you must judge whether this is worth so much struggle and decide either to live by the rules as the rest of us do or to continue the trials that no one demands of you. Then you can contemplate whether all the things that you say you do now so that we might look up to you, henceforward you will do out of love of God, and so that he might look upon you with mercy." And so it was. Sister Cecilia lay in the abbess's room for 2 weeks. She had a high fever, and Fru Groa nursed the nun herself. When she had recovered, for 8 days she had to sit at the abbess's side in the place of honor, both in church and at home, and everyone served her. She wept the whole time, as if she were being beaten. Afterward, she was much gentler and happier. She continued to live in almost the same manner as before, but she would blush like a bride if anyone looked at her, whether she was sweeping the floor or walking alone to church. This episode with Sister Cecilia aroused in Kristen a strong yearning for peace and reconciliation with everything from which she had come to feel herself cut off. She thought about Brother Edwin, and one day she gathered her courage and asked Fru Groa for permission to visit the Barefoot Friars to see a friend of hers there. She could tell that Fru Groa was not pleased. There was little friendship between the Minorites and the other cloisters of the diocese.
and the abbess was no more favorably disposed when she heard who Kristen's friend was. She said that this brother Edvin was an unreliable man of God, always roaming about the country seeking alms in other dioceses. In many places, the peasantry considered him a holy man, but he didn't seem to realize that the first duty of a Franciscan monk was obedience to his superiors. He had heard the confessions of outlaws and those who had been excommunicated. He had baptized their children and sung them into their graves without asking for permission. And yet his sin was as much due to lack of understanding as it was to defiance, and he had patiently borne the reprimands which had been imposed on him because of these matters. The church had treated him with forbearance because he was skilled at his craft, but even in the execution of his art he had come into conflict with others. The bishop's master painters in Bergen refused to allow him to work in their diocese. Kristen was bold enough to ask where this monk with the un-Norwegian name had come from. Fru Groa was in a mood to talk. She said that he was born in Oslo, but his father was an Englishman, Rickard the Armor Master, who had married a farmer's daughter from the Skogheim district, and they had taken up residence in Oslo. Two of Edvin's brothers were respected armorers in town, but Edvin, the eldest of the Armor Master's sons, had been a restless soul all his days. He had no doubt felt an attraction for the monastic life since early childhood. He had joined the gray monks at Hoveder as soon as he reached the proper age. They sent him to a cloister in France to be educated. He had excellent abilities. From there, he managed to win permission to leave the Cistercian order and enter the order of the Minorites instead. And when the brothers arbitrarily decided to build their church out in the fields to the east against the orders of the bishop, Brother Edvin had been one of the worst and most obstinate among them. He had even used a hammer to strike one of the men sent by the bishop to stop the work and had almost killed him. It had been a long time since anyone had talked at such length with Kristen. When Fru Groa dismissed her, the young maiden bent down and kissed the abbess's hand, respectfully and fervently, and tears sprang at once into her eyes. But Fru Groa, who saw that Kristen was crying, thought it was from sorrow, and so she said that perhaps one day she would be allowed to go out to visit Brother Edvin after all. And several days later, Kristen was told that some of the convent's servants had to go over to the king's castle, so at the same time they could accompany her out to the brothers in the fields. Brother Edvin was home. Kristen had not imagined that she would be so happy to see anyone other than Erlon. The old man sat and stroked her hand as they talked, thanking her for coming. No, he hadn't been to her part of the country since that night he had stayed at Urengard, but he had heard that she was to marry, and he offered her his congratulations. Then Kristen asked him to go over to the church with her. They had to go out of the cloister and around to the main entrance. Brother Edvin didn't dare lead her across the courtyard. He seemed in general quite timid and afraid to do anything that might offend. He had grown terribly old, thought Kristen. And when she had placed her offering on the altar for the priest of the church, and then asked Edvin to hear her confession, he grew quite frightened. He didn't dare. He had been strictly forbidden to listen to confessions.
"Perhaps you've heard about it," he said. "I didn't think that I could deny these poor souls the gifts that God has bestowed on me so freely. But I was supposed to exhort them to seek reconciliation at the proper place. Well then. But you, Kristen, you will have to confess to the prior at the convent."
"There is something that I cannot confess to the prior," said Kristen.
"Do you think it would benefit you if you confessed to me something that you wish to conceal from your proper confessor?"
said the monk more sternly.
"If you cannot hear my confession," said Kristen, "then you can let me talk to you and ask your advice about what is on my mind."
The monk looked around. The church was empty at the moment. He sat down on a chest that stood in the corner.
"You must remember that I cannot absolve you, but I will advise you and I will keep silent as if you had spoken in confession."
Kristen stood before him and said,
"You see, I cannot become Simon Dare's wife.
As to this matter, you know I cannot advise you otherwise than the prior would, said Brother Edwin. Disobedient children bring God no joy, and your father has done his best for you.